I want to begin by telling you about a true story that happened in 1994. I was an 18-year-old by the name of Matthew Marsloo, was working at his local Pizza Hut in Jenali. Now, I remember this story vividly because it happened just up the road from where I grew up. And he was taking the rubbish out late that night, around, I think, 11 o'clock, and when he opened the back door, he startled a gunman who was there to rob the Pizza Hut with two accomplices. And in his surprise, the gunman shot and killed Michael. Now, all three of the robbers were charged with Michael's murder, including Carl Kramer, who was sitting in the getaway car. Now, Michael's father, Ken, he originally called for the death penalty to be reinstated for his son's murderers. Yet when Ken visited Carl Kramer in prison, he had, quote, a remarkable conversion and became a strong advocate for Kramer's rehabilitation. He no longer called for the death penalty. In fact, Ken continued to visit Carl throughout his 15-year jail sentence, and when Carl was finally released, Ken was there to pick him up and to offer him a job and to help him get his life back in order. Now, what would cause a father to show such grace, such mercy, such forgiveness, such compassion to the people who murdered his son? I mean, that kind of forgiveness, well, it changes the world, doesn't it? You cannot hear about such a thing and not have it affect us in some way. Now, the passage that was just read for us sees Jesus calling us to exhibit this exact same kind of world-changing mercy and forgiveness and compassion. In recent weeks, as we mentioned before, we've been looking at this picture that Jesus is painting of the ultimate community. All right, so what does the ultimate community look like? Well, rather than allowing our anger to destroy people's lives through complaining or grumbling about them or insulting them, we rather build people up and we build relationships up. Rather than allowing our lust to lead us to treat women as little more than display objects, we actually give women the dignity and the respect they deserve as image bearers. Rather than divorcing our spouse over any and every reason, we honour our marriage covenant, all right? And in today's passage, Jesus gives us three more ways in which we can become the ultimate community. But here's the thing. Jesus has kept the best for last. This passage is seen by many as the climax, the high point to the Sermon on the Mount. Because in today's passage, we hear about a community in which people treat each other with absolute honesty and integrity. We hear about a community in which people are actually willing to give up their rights if it means being loving and caring to others. And we hear about a community in which violence is not escalated through a series of tit-for-tat revenge actions. Instead, violence is de-escalated through loving our enemies. Friends, does this not sound like a great place to live? Well, as your sermon outline shows, I've got three points that will help us become this kind of community. We're going to be looking at promoting honesty today, regulating justice. What does that mean? We'll see. And de-escalating violence. And look, these three points are perhaps the hardest commands to follow in the whole of the Sermon on the Mount. But does that really surprise us? Right? Nothing worthwhile doing in life is ever easy, and so it's not surprising that the things with the most potential to change the world are the things that are the hardest to do. But it's my prayer that this morning we will get a clearer picture and a stronger motivation to leave here today promoting honesty, regulating justice, and de-escalating violence. So we begin with Jesus' words in verse 33. Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. So this is Jesus' fourth statement in which he says, you have heard that it was said. And what's fascinating is you will not find this phrase in the Old Testament anywhere. The reason being, Jesus is not reinterpreting the Old Testament law here, as some mistakenly believe, all right? He's correcting certain false teachings of his time. And this one has to do with taking oaths. So we learn a little later in the Gospel, in Matthew chapter 23, if you want to look it up some other time, is that the Pharisees had drawn up this complex list of oath formulae. Right? If you're going to take an oath, you can say this or this or this or this. And what they said was, the closer you got to swearing on the name of the Lord, the more binding your oath was. So I'll give you an example. This is Matthew 23, verse 16. Jesus says, "Woe to you, blind guides! You say, if anyone swears by the temple, right, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath." So you see what they're getting at there? The temple building, that's a little further away from God. So God resides in the Holy of Holies, right, in the temple back in those days. If you're just swearing by the structure around it, well, you're allowed to break that oath. That's not that important. But the gold that is sitting within the temple, well, that's closer to God. And so that's more binding. And what Jesus says is, look, God's everywhere. He's omnipresent. So it doesn't matter what you swear on, whatever you swear on, you're swearing on God. So have a look at verse 34 of our passage, chapter 5. "But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it's God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king." So Jesus is doing two things here. Number one, he's tearing down this notion that certain places are closer to God or closer to God's name and therefore are more important for swearing oaths. But the bigger issue is the Pharisees had taken this Old Testament system that was designed to promote honesty and truthfulness, all right, the oath system, and they turned it into an excuse to lie and get away with it. And so Jesus says, if you're going to do that, then don't swear at all. "But I tell you, do not swear at all," verse 34. Now, here's the thing. Jesus is not condemning all oaths here. Jesus himself took oaths. The Apostle Paul took oaths. God takes an oath in Genesis 15. What Jesus is saying is, and I should say, if you and I are called to take an oath in the court of law, you know, you put your hand on the Bible, "I swear to tell the truth," we're allowed to do that. So long as that oath is designed to promote truthfulness rather than as some elaborate way to lie. Right, that's what Jesus is getting at here. I want people dealing with each other in honesty, in truthfulness. And that's why he says in verse 37, all you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. Now, we need to ask ourselves, why is Jesus so interested in honesty? Well, the reason is that lying destroys. And it does so in three ways. Firstly, lying destroys others. You see, when we don't let people see reality because we're hiding something, we're actually just exploiting them, right? They have become nothing more than an instrument for my purposes in life, for my advantage. They don't deserve the truth. Right? When we say things like that, we are stripping them of their dignity as human beings. We're actually damaging them. We're allowing them to not see reality. Second, lying destroys society. The more lying becomes entrenched in a society, the more it crumbles. Sociologists and scholars today tell us that the European communist regimes that collapsed back in the 80s, they collapsed from the inside because of entrenched deceitfulness and lying. Right? No one trusted their leaders in those countries. No one trusted their journalists, their scholars, their psychologists. Why? Because psychologists were secretly weeding out political activists. Scholars were simply towing the party line. Journalists were running the propaganda machine. And the leaders who were running the whole system, well, they were just doing it to benefit themselves. right? When truth is lost, society starts to crumble. But thirdly, lying destroys ourselves. See, whenever we do something that lacks integrity, we're actually eating away at our very identity. Now, how do you find your identity in life? You look at those things that are always true for you, right? So I am a father. I am an engineer. I am a nice person, generally. All right? Now, what happens to that identity when we lie? What happens is we don't even know who we are anymore. You know, so if I lie or I cheat or I break my word in order to advantage me, the problem is there's no me left. Now, you may be saying to yourself at this point, well, I lie all the time, Brendan. Little white lies here and there. I tell people I'm not as sinful as I really am. Make out that I've done more work than I really have. Does that mean that there's no hope for me? You know, if Jesus says this is what is required to be a Christian, then do I just need to stop being a Christian altogether, just dump this whole Christianity thing? Well, it's at this point that we need to remind ourselves of the gospel. And the gospel says the only honesty required to be a Christian, the only honesty required to get into heaven, is to be honest about our dishonesty, isn't it? What does Jesus want of his people? To be honest about the fact that we do lie. We do bend the truth. And to ask for his forgiveness. Do you know what finally led to Jesus' crucifixion? The final nail in the coffin? It was Jesus taking an oath. Let me read to you. This is from Matthew chapter 26. Verse 62, if you want to look it up some other time. You know this passage. Matthew 26, 62. Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent. The high priest then said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "He has spoken blasphemy. He is worthy of death." Now notice, Jesus remained silent until he was placed under oath. And then his answer, his true answer, is what led to him being sentenced to death. Right? Jesus told the truth to pay for our lies. So next time we are tempted to lie, may we recall to mind what Jesus went through to save us from that lie and instead be a person of integrity. Well, look, the next two sections, they're closely related, but we're going to look at them one at a time. But they're related because they're both about how we are to respond when people wrong us. Someone's done something against us to hurt us, all right? Jesus knows that's going to happen. He's giving us the answer here. So verse 38, "You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also." So Jesus is talking about justice here. Now the phrase eye for eye, tooth for tooth is actually in the Old Testament. You will find it there. And it was there to ensure a fair justice system. You see, God knows that sin has affected our sense of justice. And so when someone does something wrong to us, what's our first response? It's to pull out the heavy artillery, isn't it? Right? You slap me on the cheek, I'm going to break your jaw. I'm going to go overboard. All right? The eye for eye legal system put boundaries around that. And it did it in two ways. Number one, it ensured that the punishment fit the crime. It's not an eye and a hand for an eye. It's just an eye for an eye, all right? Punishment needs to fit the crime. But secondly, it ensured that justice was not placed in the hands of the victim, all right? There were no lynch mobs allowed back in ancient Israel. Instead, you took it to an impartial court. And just as an aside, can I just say, we need to thank God that our Australian legal system is actually based on the Bible, right? You go to a country that does not have a Christian heritage and you will notice it in their legal system. But here's the thing. As important as justice is to God, and it is important, this passage tells us there's something even more important. And that is the well-being of others. So we have, we have three examples of injustice here, right? So verse 39, if someone strikes you on the cheek. Verse 40, if someone wants to sue you and take your shirt. So we believe that's an unfair sort of legal case. And then verse 41, if someone forces you to go 1 mile. Now, what's he talking about there? We think it's some sort of military conscription. Citizens would often be forced by the government to transport military baggage from one place to another. All right, so they're forced to walk a mile carrying these bags. But here's the thing. In each instance here, justice is not Jesus' priority. Right? So if justice was Jesus' priority, he would say, if someone slaps you on the cheek, slap their cheek. Counter-sue them. Force them to go a mile. But he doesn't say that, does he? Instead, Jesus says we are to be prepared to be wronged again. Turn the other cheek. Give them your coat as well. Go 2 miles. So in each instance, the victim is being called by Jesus to open themselves up for double the hurt. Now what's going on here? Is this some sort of weird form of Christian masochism that we're talking about here? No. What Jesus is saying is, if someone hurts us, and it's going to happen, right? People sitting in this room will probably hurt us. If someone hurts us, a Christian's first thought should be about others, including the person who has hurt us. Right? So a Christian should never think about revenge. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. But what Jesus is saying here is, even hold off on thinking about justice until you've thought about what is best for everyone. Now, sometimes justice is what is best. Right? So if an offender needs to be taught to stop hurting people like they've hurt you, maybe they've hurt others as well, then perhaps justice, seeking justice, may be the right way ahead for all those involved, including the perpetrator. But Jesus wants us to think before we go looking for personal retribution. So I'll give you, I was trying to think of an example. I can only come up with a personal one. You'll excuse me. It's just a little one though. But we had a neighbor who tore down their carport and put up this massive structure, like a big garage kind of thing. And the problem was it started to block our clothesline. So we couldn't dry our clothes in the winter anymore. Now, here's the thing. Because of the size of this structure and the proximity to the fence, they needed a building permit, like a council permit to build that structure, and they didn't get one. So we could have gone to the council and demanded that they tear it down. But how then would we build relations with them to share the gospel with them? And so we took a hit for their well-being. Right? Turn the other cheek means to stop and think about what is best for others, including the person that's hurt us, and even be prepared to take more punishment if it means the greater good for them. Now that's hard, isn't it? But guess what? It gets harder. Before we look at how to do it, let's have a look at Jesus turning it up a notch. Verse 43, you have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Now again, that's not in the Bible, right? That's false teaching of the day. Verse 44, but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Now, if turn the other cheek sounds ridiculous, this is off the chart, isn't it? Love your enemies. I mean, this is even more off the chart than verse 48. Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. At least we know with that verse, Jesus doesn't expect perfection from us because he died for us. He knows we're not perfect, right? Perfection, the Greek word is sort of like a fulfilled kind of word. That's the ideal we're to be striving for, okay? But love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. How on earth can we do this kind of thing? How is it possible? Well, step one is to know that it actually can be done. People do it all the time. I want to give you just one example. All right, if we see people doing it, we say, all right, maybe it is possible for me to do it. That's step one. Nelson Mandela. Now, he's not without his critics, all right, but Nelson Mandela is widely seen as one of the greatest leaders of our modern era. Why? Was it because of his economic reforms? No. It's because he held together a country that was about to rip itself apart through racial violence and revenge. See, when Nelson Mandela was elected president in 1994, the black South Africans were looking for revenge on the whites, the Afrikaners, for decades of violence and racial oppression under apartheid. Blacks now had the upper hand. It's time for revenge. Mandela knew that the only way ahead, the only way to stop this country from ripping itself apart from the inside, was to make reconciliation his main policy. Was his main policy. Now, this is depicted for us wonderfully in the movie Invictus. There's this one scene. Now, it's about the South African, the Springboks, soccer team, right? Soccer team? I'm joking. Rugby team. The sporting body, which was all black, had just voted to completely overhaul the Springboks because the Afrikaners loved Springboks rugby. And they were thinking, we hate the whites. Let's hurt them. Let's overhaul it all. And Nelson Mandela turns up unannounced to this meeting after they had voted unanimously to do this. And he pleaded with them to change their minds. And he said, look, the Afrikaners are, quote, I'm quoting the movie here. He says, they are no longer our enemies. They're fellow South Africans. And if we take away the Springboks from them, we become everything they fear. And we need to be better than that. We need to surprise the Afrikaners with compassion, with restraint and generosity. The very things we were denied. For, he says, this is not the time for petty revenge. This is the time to build our nation using every single brick available to us. And he did. He held that nation together for years. Started to go downhill recently after his death. But friends, that's how you change the world. Right? You don't change the world through petty revenge, through torturing our enemies, through an escalation of violence. You change the world through surprising our enemies with things like compassion, restraint, and generosity. And friends, here's the thing. When we're doing that, we are being children of our Father in heaven, verse 45. That's why he asks us to do it. Right? If you want to be a child of Satan, then go and do what Satan likes. Satan likes vengeance. Satan likes payback and coldness and cruelty. He wants us to hold on to our anger and our hatred and make them pay for what they did to us. What God wants is compassion, restraint, and generosity. Why? Because that's how he operates with us, isn't it? See, the fascinating thing about the cross is not God being slapped on the cheek. It's God being slapped on the other cheek. Our sin was the first slap. Every single time one of his creatures sins against him, rebels against him, it is a slap on the cheek for God. Yet rather than slap us back, right, that would be justice, eye for an eye, God took that second slap, didn't he? You see, the difference between God and the father of that murdered 18-year-old is that Ken Marzlew forgave Carl Kramer for killing his son. God forgave you and I by killing his son. Do you see the infinite disparity between those two things? The cross is God being hurt a second time for our sin at infinite cost to himself. And so next time we are hurt by someone, and it might be here at church, what are we going to do? Are we going to be like Satan, whom the Bible describes as the father of lies? Or are we going to be like our Father in heaven? Now, if we want to be like God, if we want to be children of our Father in heaven, what is that going to look like? I want to give us three quick steps towards turning the other cheek, towards loving our enemies as we close. Step one is this. We go and talk to the person who hurt us. We act like an adult and we treat them like an adult. And we go and explain to them how they've hurt us. And look, if they don't listen, take someone else along with you. There's steps for that in the Bible. Step two, we offer them forgiveness. Now, this is not easy, right? I know this from experience. Forgiveness means we're paying the debt that someone else owes us. It's costly to forgive. But if we keep in mind the infinite debt Jesus has paid for us, well, it makes their debt look a little smaller, doesn't it? A little easier to pay. And number three, we show them compassion, restraint, and generosity. Right? Don't write them off as unable to be reconciled with. Don't grumble against them. Don't avoid them. Rather, we are to surprise them with the same treatment we've been shown by Jesus of compassion, restraint, and generosity. Because that's how we change the world, friends, isn't it? By being the kind of community God wants us to be. He wants us to be a community that promotes honesty rather than destroys people or society with our lies. He wants us to be a community that regulates justice. We don't go straight in for justice. We think about it. And we think about what is best for those involved, even if it means giving up our right to justice. And he wants us to be a community that de-escalates violence through forgiveness. As Nelson Mandela once said, courageous people do not fear forgiving for the sake of peace. Friends, if we could do that, and it can only happen through Jesus' strength, who has done it for us, then imagine the kind of community we could become. Does that not sound like the kind of community you want to be a part of?